Thank you, Ted, for that great introduction, and thanks very much to Ted and for inviting me, and thanks to you guys for coming to listen and to read. Can you hear me okay from here? Would you, yes, nod if you can, yes? Okay, all right. So, as Ted said, I'm going to read a section from my first novel, which is called The Last Summer of the World, which looks at the life of the early art photographer Edward Steichen, both during his service in World War I, flying reconnaissance missions for the American army in France, and also his life before the war. Before the outbreak of World War I, Steichen, who was American, lived in France for many years, and so when he went back to fight, he was actually returning to a place that was, his home. And so the novel looks at both, his time in France during the summer of 1918, and also his time there during the years leading up to that. He had a very difficult first marriage, which came to an end around that time, and the book attempts to tell that story as well. So the section I'm going to read this evening is from that pre-war period, and it's entitled Incoming Tide, Brittany 1914. I think that's more or less all you need to know. Steichen was married to a woman called Clara, and this scene takes place in the house that they lived in the Marne Valley. First, she empties the silverware drawer. Knives, forks, spoons. She pulls from where they are stored, bundled in cloths and newly polished, and with the flourish of a juggler releases them into the empty air. They rise from her hands, sinews of light sliding down their surfaces. For a moment, they seem to hang suspended, a bright, hard chaos. Then they fall. They crash onto the flagstones and scatter, and the noise rings out calamitous. She does this again and again, watching him all the time until the drawer lies empty and the floor at her feet glimmers with complicated silver hieroglyphs. Then, since there is no more silverware, she balls up the tablecloth and hurls that at him. He sees it arc through the air towards his head and instinctively puts up his arms to shield himself. The white mass explodes softly against his elbow. It floats down silently, settling into a heap of crumpled linen, and Edward thinks how oblivious the tablecloth remains to its present use as a weapon. Meanwhile, Clara is searching through the dresser behind her for something else to throw, and looking up, he sees her pause, then open one of the top cupboards and reach inside. She begins to pull something out of it, something heavy that requires both hands to lift it. That cupboard is where they keep the china. In a moment, he's across the room. He encircles her wrists with his hands. His thumb and forefinger are enough to stretch all the way around, and he pulls them away from the cupboard so he's holding her arms in front of her, above her head. This close, he can hear her breath coming in bursts. She struggles against him, but he keeps her there, immobile, at arm's length. His anger rises in his chest, a heavy, solid mass that makes it difficult to speak, so when he opens his mouth, all that comes out is a hiss. "How dare you," he whispers. She stares back at him, her eyes a defiant blank. From behind him comes the sound of the back door creaking open, footsteps of someone entering the kitchen from the garden. Edward turns towards the noise, loosening his grasp on Clara as he does so. She twists away from him, lets out a high, frustrated sound, somewhere between a scream and a grunt, and runs from the dining room, shoving the door open so it slams closed behind her. There is a crash of dissonance from the front parlor as she drops the lid of their piano, a sound like wings flapping. She's throwing sheet music. Her footsteps bite into each stair as she climbs to the second floor. The door of their bedroom opens, then slams shut. Sobbing follows, ragged, barely audible. Edward stands alone in the kitchen, in the dining room, which is suddenly thickly quiet. He puts both hands on the big wooden table in front of him and leans forward onto them. He wants the table to absorb his anger, to drain it away so that he can face the owner of the footsteps, which are getting steadily louder, coming along the corridor towards him. He breathes. The door creaks open. Francois, the gardener, peers into the room. He looks at the chaos on the floor, then at Edward. I heard noises, he says. He waits on the threshold, his arms braced against the doorframe. At that moment, he is the most solid object in the room. It's nothing, Edward says. The old man nods slowly. An accident, maybe, he suggests. Yes, says Edward gratefully, that's it. Francois shrugs, then goes out. His footsteps recede back down the corridor, as unhurried as before. An accident, Edward thinks. Yes. He stoops down and picks up the tablecloth, folds it, puts it away. He begins to gather up the silver. From beyond, from above him, the sound of crying continues to slip between the floorboards, under the doors, surreptitiously filling up the house. After a few minutes, he isn't sure he hears it at all, but if some other, more tactile sense attunes him to her. He can feel the storm in his solar plexus. His nerves are sympathetic strings. He thinks his skin knows things. An accident. It isn't exactly a lie to describe their fights that way, because that is how they always feel to him. Like a collision he could not possibly have anticipated or avoided, a disaster that comes out of nowhere. He quite literally has no idea what he said or did to make her flare up so suddenly. But then there are times when she's like this, when she's volatile. An offhand comment or a casual action will open a trapdoor in her and she'll fall through it, pulling him after her. At these times there's no talking to her. He could go upstairs, sit down on the bed beside her, touch her hair. He could use the softest words he knows, but all this will do is reignite her. Nothing he says will be any good. She will turn it back on him, twisting it into something he never intended. She will hear only insults, disregard, selfishness. And in any case, he's too angry himself to speak to her now. Usually, when this happens, he will simply walk out of the house, taking nothing with him but his keys and jacket. He'll go down to the station in Esbly and get on the train to Paris. He'll spend a few days in his studio there, not answering the door, absorbed in the process of developing and printing his photographs, and work will dissolve the argument so he can return to her with his anger gone. This has become a rhythm for him. He withdraws to the city after a fight, and each of them has time to become calm. When they first moved to Voulangy, he planned to get rid of his studio in Montparnasse and take all his equipment up to their house in the Marne, where he was building a darkroom against one wall of the garden. The darkroom has been finished for years, and Clara has pointed out more than once the expense of keeping two studios. She even hinted that he kept his rooms in the city for other, more nefarious reasons, and after that he thought seriously about giving them up to allay her fears. But each time he is about to relinquish his apartment in Paris, he stops. He knows something that he cannot, he knows somewhere that he cannot get by without it. He has found that he needs this valve in his life. He would like to go there now, soothe himself with the sound of the train rocking over the rails, then with work and solitude, perhaps a visit to Meudon to see Rodin. But today, that will not be possible. Marion Beckett is driving up from Paris to stay with them for the month of July. She is due to arrive after lunch, and then Arthur and Mercedes will come later in the evening. That Clara should choose this day to relinquish her hold on propriety, when she knows they are expecting visitors, damn her, damn her. It only adds to his annoyance and anger. What on earth is she thinking? It is already 11:30. He stands up. If he cannot have the freedom of Paris, at least he will get some work done before the guests arrive. He leaves the rest of the silverware on the floor and goes out into the kitchen yard. Louisa is there, hanging sheets on the line. He comes up beside her and touches her gently on the shoulder. I'm afraid Madame isn't feeling very well. She dropped some things in the kitchen. When you have a minute, would you pick them up and put them away? Louisa frowns and nods. Yes, she said, since Madame is indisposed again. He lets himself through the gate into the back garden. It is a stunningly clear day. There is a loveliness to the summers here that almost defies belief. Each blade of grass seems to be lit from within. Later, he will remember that these days seemed fragile in their beauty, but he will not be able to distinguish whether this is from the manufacture of memory because of what came after. On this day, he notices the delphiniums are folded, their stored brightness nearly bloomed. Francois kneels nearby, transplanting larkspur and irises to the beds under the fruit trees. He glances up at as Edward makes his way across the bright lawn, but doesn't pause from his work. Edward raises his hand in greeting, then goes quickly and unlocks his studio door. He feels embarrassed in front of the old man. Even though he knows this is foolish, Clara's temper is not his fault, but still, he wants right now to have walls enclosing him, to vanish into the controlled stillness of his negatives, their safety. His studio smells of the unvarnished timber out of which he built the walls, a dusty, sweet odor that calms him instantly. He stands in the vestibule and inhales the smell of wood, turpentine, paint, then comes in and closes the door behind him. The structure is divided into two rooms, a studio for painting and a dark room for developing and printing at the far end. He put a skylight in the room on this side to give himself natural light. He crosses the room, laying his hands on the physical objects it contains as he goes, the workbench, the easel, the shelves where he stores his paints and brushes, reassuring himself that they are really there. He loves their solidity, the way they take up space. He loves the balanced weight of the brush or the camera in his hands. He goes to the door that leads to the darkroom and ducks inside, latching it behind him. He has hung black curtains about 2 feet behind the door, and he parts these and steps inside, turning the overhead safe light so that the room appears around him in scarlet. A month ago, he took some pictures on a trip to Brittany, to the Brittany coast. He hasn't yet had time to print them. The negatives are in the shelf over the sink, boxed and labeled. He brings them down and carries them out to his workbench. Against the white surface, he examines them one by one. They offer him their miniature worlds with light and darkness reversed. In the first one, taken on a beach, the low tide is just beginning to turn. The sea has gone out, leaving the rocky shore exposed. His daughters have clambered out to find anemones among the tidal pools, crabs in their slow armor, whiskery fish with transparent skins. Mary is lying stretched out on a ledge of rock on her belly, peering down into the water. Her black fingers trace its surface, while Kate stands knee-deep in it, looking at him out of white eyes in her shadow-colored face. The girls' white mouths smile, and their white hair is tangled up in the wind coming off the sea. Above them, a dark sun has blown out of the clouds and is turning the sea's surface to ribbons of slate. This one he will print, he decides. He'll put it on platinum paper so that he can get the full spectrum of tones. Then maybe he will try gum bichromate, though the picture seems to demand clarity. It is not soft enough for him to bring his brushes to it. The moment should be just as it is, undisturbed. That day, he remembers, he'd followed the children out over the rocks chasing this photograph. He found himself out of breath as he tried his footing on each new ledge, and his shoes slipped on the barnacles and soft green seaweeds that grew up to the high water line. When he looked up, the girls were already far ahead of him, waving and beckoning, and he laughed and started after them again. Clara, standing on the shore, called, "For God's sakes, be careful." And he waved to show her that he was fine, she shouldn't worry so much. The girls had eluded him for a while before they grew tired from running and climbing, and he could finally catch up with them. He found them wading, absorbed in the contents of a single pool, as though it were the whole world. He'd lain down on the rock opposite so he could photograph them from their own height. When they made it at last back to the beach, all three of them were exhausted, their clothes covered in green and brown smudges and their hair full of salt. Clara had been angry. "Look at the state of you," she said to Mary. "Look at your dress. It's filthy." "We were having an adventure," Edward said, and he came up and kissed her on the cheek despite her glowering expression. "Isn't that right, girls?" "Yes, yes," said Mary. "That's right." Kate grinned and nodded. "You can't worry about her clothes," he told her, "when you are on an adventure." He was determined not to let her spoil the beauty of the afternoon. He wanted to have peace. He didn't want to deal with her sudden peevishness, her dissatisfaction that seemed to take in the whole world, her husband, her daughters, herself. He took the girls both by the hand and kept walking down the beach away from her. What if the tide had come in while you were out there? She called after him. I couldn't even see you from here. How could I have known to call for help? Edward, why aren't you listening to me? Her words follow them over the sand until the wind blows them out to sea. Now he carries the plate back to the darkroom and inserts it in the enlarger, focuses the light on the printing frame, then flicks it off again. He opens the drawer where he keeps platinum paper and fills a developing tray with potassium oxalate. He's irritated to find his mind occupied again with Clara. He had come in here to escape her. Never mind, he thinks, as he fits the paper into the frame. What had he said this morning that had upset her so much? He goes over the scene in his head. She had been playing piano in the front parlor. The children were at school until noon, and he'd just come in to tell her he'd invited a couple of additional guests to stay at the house, Mercedes de Cordoba and Arthur Calles. They would be coming up that very afternoon from the city. They probably wouldn't be staying long. And they were such close friends, it wasn't necessary to make a big fuss for them or any elaborate preparations. He thought she'd be pleased. She likes both Mercy and Arthur a lot. She's declared it loudly, in the way she has at the end of an evening when she is tired or a little drunk. I really do love Arthur. He's such a dear man. It didn't occur to Edward that the news of the impending arrival would be a cause for anger. But when he told her about it, Clara had stopped playing and looked at him with an expression of disbelief. Then she put her head down on the keys of the piano so that a chromatic mass of notes rose out of the instrument and engulfed her, filling the room with dissonance. And then just a short section from a little bit later where we get the scene from Clara's point of view. He'd come in when she was beginning the third movement of a Franck composition for solo piano, the Fugue, and stood beside her with one elbow leaned on the top of the upraised lid. That was her stolen hour, the first she'd had to play all week, and she'd been congratulating herself on having salvaged it by getting up early and finishing the Silver before the first of their summer guests arrived. 1 hour was not so much, but somehow it would have to be enough, and she had begun with scales, running her fingers lightly up and down the keys, then moving up a semitone. She imagined the notes like water in an ocean wave, caught and held aloft, then gently dropped back down to be picked up again in a different current, another key, C, C sharp, D, E flat. Her fingers worked unconsciously, and she felt energy begin to flow through them. She started the piece sight-reading as she went, but pleased to be beginning something new. And then there he was, standing too close for her to ignore, flipping through the scores stacked on the top of the piano, glancing idly at the titles and waiting for the chance to speak to her. This appeared to be the nature of the day, then, that everything she tried to do would be interrupted. Earlier, after getting the girls breakfasted and off to school, she had been seated in the kitchen at the kitchen table, polishing the last of the silverware, watching her reflection come up, clear and upside down in the faces of the spoons, when she heard voices in the kitchen yard, Louisa, and then a deeper voice, male, that she couldn't identify. She went to the window and looked out. Louisa was leaning on the fence, talking to a man dressed in dark, rough coveralls of a farmhand. Clara didn't know his name, but his face was familiar. He must work on one of the farms nearby. The two of them were standing very close together. Then the man leaned back and swung lazily on the fence, his arms making the radius of an arc traced by his long body. He said something that she couldn't hear, and then burst out laughing, the sound harsh in the quiet. Louisa laughed too, high and nervous. Behind her, the laundry Clara needed for tomorrow lay half finished, shirts and underwear floating in a tub of soapy water, the plunger beside it on the ground discarded. Clara had gone to the door, opened it, and closed it again hard. The sound of it slamming shut was enough. Louisa started up and looked around, and the man took off hurriedly towards the road. Clara watched him go across the fields, headed away from town. He must have come, she thought, from the farm belonging to Claude Perrine, the man who also served as the local garde champêtre. They were on good terms with Claude. If she saw him, she would speak to him about the man, but Louisa was another matter. Clara stopped playing and looked up at Edward. I found Louisa chatting with one of Claude Perrine's men this morning, she said. Could you speak to her about that? Why, he asked, turning the pages of some Chopin piano pieces. Is she not allowed to speak to men now? Of course she is, but not while she's supposed to be doing the washing. You're too hard on her, Edward said. What harm can it do for her to talk? Will you play this nocturne for us this evening? Arthur loves Chopin when you play it. Please, Edward, if I say anything about it, she'll just glare at me. I'll speak to her, he said, I promise. He promises things when he doesn't want to talk about them anymore, she knows. It's his way of ending the conversation and moving on to something that he thinks is more important. Darling, I've asked a couple of extra people to come up from the city this weekend. Arthur Broughton said he so wanted to come and paint here again this month. I told him he could if he liked. He and Mercy are going to come up by train this evening. You can put her in the bed next to Marion, and Arthur can sleep in the study. Could you make the bed up for them in there? So there it was, her precious hour gone. How long will he be staying? She asked. Well, for the rest of the month, I should think. Not too long. I really didn't ask him. He opened up the book to a polonaise and held it up for her to see. Or you could play this one. Clara put her head down on the keys of the piano. Around her, she felt the notes coming up and covering her as though they wanted to drown her. She wished they could. Above her, she saw her husband gazing down with a perplexed look on his face. What on earth is the matter? He asked. Nothing. She felt tears rising in her face, her throat tightened. I just sat down to play. It's been my first chance to practice for days. Edward nodded. Well, maybe you should try to practice a little earlier in the day, he said, when there's less going on. What have you been doing this morning while I've been out? He doesn't understand anything. He doesn't even know what she does with her time. No wonder, really, since in the last year he's spent so much time traveling. If she's honest, she knows that her greatest fear is that she will decide to stay in bed forever and he won't notice she's gone. After all, Louisa can cook and do the chores, he'll have his friends for company, and she is absolutely sure that more than one of the other women that they know would happily provide the other thing for him. She knows, of course, about Isadora Duncan. The news had reached her about a year after the affair ended. Quite casually, one of their acquaintances, Judith Claudel, who wrote for the newspapers, mentioned that she had seen Edward in Paris with that woman at a party the summer before Clara had become pregnant with Kate. Oh, she had said, I didn't know she was in France then. Judith had turned bright red and stuttered. Well, I'm sure he simply forgot to mention it, but the embarrassment had told her everything she needed to know. Other bits of evidence had assembled themselves into a story in her head, other meetings he had forgotten, letters he had gone to his studio to read. The worst of it, she sometimes felt, was how little he had tried to hide it, prancing around with that woman just as though it was the most innocent thing in the world, as though it was absolutely right for him to act that way. She thinks that the affair had ended by the time she put the pieces together, and she's also fairly certain that it hasn't resumed since, if only because Isadora, amazing, shocking woman, has moved on to other liaisons far more notorious. At the time of her discovery, she had tried to talk to their friends about it, to find out more of what had gone on. She had written to Alfred Stieglitz, who she'd been told had seen Edward and that Duncan woman together in New York some years before. He had written back, telling her to dismiss such thoughts from her, as he put it, silly head. He didn't deny that the affair had taken place. You married him knowing all his faults, he wrote instead. He loves you as well as he knows how and works hard to support you. What more can you ask? And in the end, she supposes he is right. For what was there to say or do? She has two small children and nowhere to go. And anyway, for a while around the time of Kate's birth, he had seemed so much more present. He had loved her the way she had always imagined. But the world encroached. He became distracted. A again by travel and work, and for all she knows there may be other women, she no longer feels that she can entirely dismiss that possibility. Women love him, dote on him. If she were to seclude herself, she would merely be getting out of their way, making it a little bit easier for them. From downstairs, she hears the sound of the girls arriving home for their midday meal. Louisa would give it to them in the kitchen, and then they would go back to school for their afternoon lessons. She rises quickly and locks the door. She doesn't want to see her children now. Then she flops back down on the bed and puts her hands over her face so the world goes dark again. Okay, thank you very much.